creating cultural awareness and understanding. This is Culture Click. Culture Click is written and produced by KQAL-FM on the campus of Winona State University.
From early ages, young boys are socialized to act out normative masculine scripts. They are taught that being a man means to be competitive, controlling, tough, and emotionally restrictive. Research has shown that many men are socialized to perceive sexual promiscuity as a marker of personal success and self-worth. Last week on Culture Click, we presented a talk by Dr. Jonathan Luke Wood from San Diego State University on hegemonic masculinity. Dr. Wood brought his research on the subject to present his findings alongside with Dr. Mary Jo Klinker from Winona State University's Women's and Gender Studies program. Today we continue the conversation with a panel discussion made up of members from the community and Winona State University's campus. Please be aware that today's program contains adult themes and language. I'm Terry Tenseth, inviting you to learn more now on Culture Click.
What we'd like to have a panel do first is just to start from the end with Alex, if you could go first and just introduce yourself.
Alexander Hines.
And what do you do?
I'm the Director of Inclusion and Diversity.
Okay.
Gar Kellum, Director of Student Support Services.
Tony Spencer, I coach football here.
Aaron Anderson Walker, football player, CMU major.
Dr. Joel Fillmore, Counselor Education.
I'm Sue Hang, this is my third year here.
My name is Alex Paulson. I am Full Spectrum Gender and Sexuality Alliance Public Outreach Chair.
Jesse Mancilla, graduate student.
Welcome, thank you.
Well, I guess we're gonna start with a definition and then a question to begin. Just to give you a little bit of background as to why I'm here. In 2008, I was asked to teach for the first time a contemporary masculinities course, and at the time, I didn't think it really necessarily was about my life. And you know, the more that I recognized how pervasive, as you say, hegemonic masculinity is, I realized that it was about every man that I'd ever loved in my life. It was about every experience I had had of violence, which brought me to the reason that I do women's studies to begin with. And so masculinity is a part of my life, despite the fact I identify as a femme woman. So it's always going to be. So one thing that I like to use, and there are a few of you in here from masculinities, which is great, to think about hegemonic masculinity are a few criteria that have been theorized by Deborah David and Robert Brannon, which is hegemonic masculinity is always a heterosexual matrix, right? It's defined by, as you point out, access to women's bodies, access to heterosexuality. But then there are four criteria that men can perform and institutions can enact, and those are no sissy stuff, as you point out, don't be a bitch, don't be a fag. Be a big wheel, that is access power in any way possible. Be a sturdy oak, don't cry, don't be a girl. And finally, give them hell. You know, this is an example of give them hell, why there are more men who die in high-speed car accidents than there are women. Okay, it's the behavior of masculinity. And I guess what I'd like to start out with is maybe if some of you would like to speak to the way that these criteria of hegemonic masculinity have impacted your life, and maybe thinking about how hegemonic masculinity might be more than just an individual issue, but a public health issue that we could consider.
You know, one of the things that I'd really like to start pointing out is that this whole conversation appears to be from a heteronormative kind of perspective, but that's really not the reality of it. Keeping in mind that all males are socialized the same way, because we don't know when a baby's born and whether they're going to be gay or straight. And I identify as delicious and amazing. So, understanding that. So you know, Dr. Wood had talked about how the way men are socialized leads to aggression and this idea of like keeping score, like a scorecard, promiscuity. Well, most of you, if I look around the room, most of you weren't around in the 80s. You weren't born. Well, in the 80s, we had an epidemic called AIDS that happened. And it was perpetuated by this idea of promiscuity within the gay community. But that was predicated on this idea of, if you're a man, you get it. You get it as much as you can. And so I want to be sure that we're not just talking about this conversation from a heteronormative perspective, but we're being much more inclusive. So thinking about my life and how that idea of hegemonic masculinity has really impacted me and people within the queer community, I think it really, if you look at contemporary gay community, you see this hyper-masculinity, you know, and there's sissy shaming within the gay community, which I think is incredibly offensive. And it's ironic, too, in that you're a disenfranchised population. You take on this identity because you feel like it's going to give you this sense of equality or acceptance, and then you demonize individuals who perpetuate this, for lack of a better word, this over-sexualized ideology of what it means to be a gay man or a lesbian woman. So there's so much hypocrisy just within those dynamics and those paradigms. And I think it's really important that this conversation be much broader than just a heteronormative one.
Yes, and let me say that I usually start when I talk to conversations like this to give that disclaimer at the beginning, and I did forget to do so, and you are right, it was from that perspective. Yeah.
Oh, I managed
you,
honey. That's good.
Anyone else want to talk about hegemonic masculinity?
Well, I think it's very important that we, as a society, recognize what men are socialized to be. And personal experience, I went to prison. I did 6 years because of a crime that I committed. And then it's a criminal sexual conduct. And I started to realize how important I am being a man and socialized to behave in a certain way. And it takes, you know, self-knowledge. You know, they say self-knowledge is, self-knowledge corrects, knowledge of oneself corrects one's self, you know. So it's like I started dig deep into it, and I realized the importance of how media or how I'm supposed to behave and act as a man. And it's very, you know, unfortunate that this happened. And so I realized the importance of knowing who I am and what I can do. I can't stress it enough, you know.
I'll kind of hit an aspect of it, and Sue kind of talked upon it, of course. From an athletic point of view, it always seems like that athletes are considered, you know, they always have a certain thing about them, so to speak, whether it's, you know, they have anger issues or you know, they're always, they seem to be the more masculine ones, so to speak. But again, it's all about knowing who you are, as well as knowing the other people around you. So I think that's huge. With this being said, again, like I said, Sue hit it right on the head when he talked about the whole thing with knowing who you are. For instance, everybody's heard about the whole Michael Sam thing. You know, I mean, that comes into play, as well as. Was Jason Collins, or if I'm not mistaken, is that the name of the NBA player? So, I mean, it's all kind of something that we all have to deal with. I don't want to say deal with, that we all learn from and everything. So it's huge. It's huge.
I think you can look at it from different perspectives. You just brought up the 80s. I'm a child of the 60s and 70s. So I have to look at it from a male role model perspective. So when I'm looking at the 60s, here we have all these males, and I don't care what their sexual orientation is, sexual identity. We had males, and we've had gay black men forever, gay black people forever, lesbian black people forever. But it was the role model, it was the information, it was how they lived their lives that modeled that to you. And some of you young folks that listen to certain music and watch certain movies, you think that that's just now. So going back to the 70s, you're talking about the 80s, my role model was Superfly. Superfly got a sister on this side of town. He got a white woman on this side of town. He got all these women, the Mac, pretty long. I used to have pretty long flowing hair. I'm light-skinned, and I'm a pretty boy. I want all the women. I'm the big wheel. So today, y'all call yourselves ballers, players, hustlers, and pimps. This image has been in the media since 1970s with the black exploitation era. So even then, the media said that we were hypersexual males. No matter if we were gay or heterosexual, we were hypersexual. And it's still the same way today that we're hypersexual. Not just all males, but specifically males of color. That all we want is to hit it and quit it. We want another notch on our belt. And like Dr. Wood said, all women are as objects. Some of the guys even look at you like a piece of meat. Especially freshmen coming in. We don't have this conversation. When you come into college campuses, new meat on campus, you hear that from the guys. Oh yeah, I'm gonna hit that.
Fresh meat.
Fresh meat.
Yeah.
So it's the images that are perpetuated in the media about us, no matter our race, ethnicity, our sexual identity, our gender orientation. So if we're not having those conversations, then we all in here uphold what I call white supremacy. Because nobody that looks like us sitting here are running the media. Are distributing. What about the music you listen to? Let's talk about bitch. White guys do say you cry like a pussy. You cry like a little girl. We say you cry like a bitch or a little bitch. Those are the conversations we don't want to have with each other about our own heterosexual privilege. You've heard it on campus. Even ladies, I hear you saying it on campus. You call each other bitches. But if I walk up to some of you in the club or bar or out when you calling each other bitches, I go, hi, bitches. Smiling. Y'all be like, no, he didn't. But you're lowering yourself to a form of bestiality. But when we lower you to a form of bestiality, now it's an attitude. But as soon as that rapper, Lil Wayne, Chris Brown talk about these hoes ain't loyal. All these bitches out here. Y'all out on the dance floor. I'm not saying all of you. You're on the dance floor and shaking it, rubbing it up on some guy. But then we don't want to have that conversation. So when do we have the real conversations about what's happening with gender and relationships?
Yeah, and I think if you look at, again, going back to the whole socialization piece, you know, kind of a personal story. You know, my husband and I raised our nephew, Michael, since he was 10. And yes, he put a ring on it. Back up. He's 22 now, so we've had him for 12 years. You know, unfortunately, he chose to be straight. I don't know what I did wrong. And so, but that whole idea of internalized homonegativity and this idea of what is masculine and what is not, even it just infiltrates within our own community. My nephew graduated from the University of Illinois in May. And so we were in Chicago, and we had a big party afterwards, and he's the ultimate good guy. He doesn't smoke, he doesn't drink, he doesn't do anything like that. But everyone else, we're all partying for him, you know, drinking, having fun. He had a female friend. It wasn't his girlfriend. He's like, no, she's not my girlfriend because I'm moving to Minnesota. I don't want to be in a commitment relationship. So I'm sitting here talking to this young lady, trying to find out, you know, if she's worthy of him. And she says to me, so you and Angel raised Michael, huh? And I said, yeah. And I said, he didn't even turn out gay. And as soon as I said, he goes, I think I'm going to make some chocolate-covered strawberries. I said, well, he's a little gay. Why? Because he wanted to make some chocolate-covered strawberries. So that was that whole internalized idea of what is and what isn't masculine. And I said it out of my mouth. And you would think that would be the last thing I would say. But I jokingly said, yeah, he's a little gay. Because he wanted to make chocolate-covered strawberries. Because that's the kind of guy he is. Because we raised his ass right. You know, get up and cook. Make something. You know, so.
I have a little different perspective that might help. And maybe a story. Because when I was in school, back in the 60s, we were in a fraternity. I was fraternity pledge class president. And we had a meeting one night. And the word was, we were to start Hell Week. Hell Week starts on Monday. Which meant we were supposed to go over to the house and get paddled with wooden paddles. You had a wooden paddle. That was so they'd paddle you. Sit on kegs of ice in your underwear. Carry the books for the actives. Stay up all night, do all sorts of crazy abuses, be abused, basically. So we had this meeting, and I said to the guys, what do you want to do? And they said, we don't want to go through Hell Week. We don't want to be abused. So the question was, what should we do? So we got out of town. We rented a truck, and we drove out of town to a motel, called the actives, and said, there will be no Hell Week. You know, cancel Hell Week. We won't go through it. And they were mad. because they said, you have to go through it because we went through it. We were abused, you got to be abused. That's the way it works. It doesn't happen. You can't break the chain. You have to be hazed in those days. As an athlete, you had to have those kinds of things happen to you. But we broke the chain. Eventually, they gave up. We were initiated. They didn't like it. They said we ruined the fraternity. But that was an experience for me of who guys really are. And so what I want to talk about briefly is my research, which is about who guys really are, not who they think they should be. And that's what I heard from Luke, and that's what I heard from so many of the panelists and Alex. We are socialized to think we have to do all this stuff. And if I did a survey of everybody here tonight, I would bet that you would take Brannon's four pillars or Jim O'Neill's restricted emotionality, restricted affection behavior. You know, they're pretty much the same. Traditional masculinity. If you gave a survey and you said to everybody here, how committed are you, whether you're a spouse or a girlfriend or a family member, to traditional masculinity, it wouldn't be that high. But if I gave you the same survey and said, how high do you think your friends would score every single time and every single person, you would say they are higher on the traditional masculinity score than you are. It's a social norm, right?
We emasculate each other.
We do it to ourselves. Our girlfriends do it. Our spouses do it. Our parents do it.
Man up.
But this is what I want you to understand. We don't really want to do it. We do it because we think we're supposed to do it. So how do you break it? You have a safe place. Brilliant. It's brilliant, right? GLBT education is creating a safe place. Do the same thing. Create a safe place. Allow people to be who they are. Exactly what Tony was saying. Be who you are. And you will discover that you don't want to perpetuate the stuff. I mean, some guys will. You know, it's not universal. But by and large, I think if you want to break the chain, create safe spaces, men's groups, allow them places they can get together like Alex did the other night with about 70 guys here. And then talk honestly, like our pledge class, like we don't want to be hazed. Who does? Why perpetuate it?
I also think we need to be careful, too, because women, because they're socialized in the same culture as the rest of us, they perpetuate it, too. What's your name?
Aaron.
Aaron, this is a big old boy. Now, imagine Aaron is your boyfriend, and y'all out at Frozen. Let it go, let it go. And he starts crying. You're going to look at him like he's crazy. So women will say, I want a guy who can show his emotion, but it's, you punk ass, why are you crying? Stop crying. So we need to be careful that it's not just a one-sided conversation as well.
I don't think we really mentioned health issues like you said, which leads to stress, anxiety, depression, because males, this is what we like to do to each other. You mentioned some of the stereotypes. So I know that we want males to advocate against sexual assault and domestic violence, right? Well, if we go to a party and we stop females from drinking and we get back to our peer group, so one, you become a blocker. But we get superhero status like we showed the superheroes in our presentation. You get a cape thrown around your back. Now you become Captain Save-A-Hole. Now you're isolated from the group. Now you start experiencing isolation, anxiety, depression, and that you don't fit in. So there are some health issues as well as if you're promiscuous besides AIDS, gonorrhea, VD, bladder infections, urinary tract infections, which leads to other complications.
Oh yeah, sorry, can I
love that question?
Yes, ask. Sorry, I saw you like raising your hand out there and I wanted like next opportunity.
The following question was asked from an audience member. As a female with males in my family, I witnessed the masculinity socialization that happens, and it has really harmed some people, especially my younger cousins. I see them struggle with it. How do I, as a female in my position, help them?
On the flip side, I was raised by all women. So to say that, a little bit of freedom, but while leaving that guiding shoulder to be there to lend them in the right direction, by all means, if they have questions and they're curious, or if they need help with a certain topic, you'd be there for them to share the little information they need to, you know, be willing to do that or cease and move on to the next one. Same thing with sports, same thing with music, same thing with academics. they'll find that niche that suits them best, but they just need a little bit of support and guidance. I wouldn't say push them towards it or try to frame them in the box. There's no box. Break out of it.
I think the question actually ties back to what you were finishing with, Alex. And the fact is, hegemonic means consenting. We're all a part of consenting to this culture in some way or another. And a big part of that means, you know, as women who might deal with hegemonic masculinity, both as victims but also as people who are supporting men in their lives, challenging things like, you know, Frozen, calling someone a bitch for crying during Frozen. I haven't seen Frozen, but, you know,
you will cry, honey.
Because this is a difficult topic, and I think that you're bringing this up, I wanted to really quick, before we go any further, I think there are trained advocates in the room. Is there anyone willing to? Okay. So if anyone needs to talk to anyone after this event, I think that's a good thing that we're aware of who are trained advocates, too. So did you want to add a?
Oh, I'm trained advocate,
too. Okay.
A member of the audience asked about when males push up on females in a public place. Is it taking power away from the female by sticking up for her? What is the correct way to handle the situation if you witness it? Alexander Hines gives us an example of how he approaches it in his own life.
I love my wife. So when men, I'm out, and men try to push up on her, I just sit back. I'm not trying to take up for her because she's going to put you in check as a male. Now, if you try to push up a different way, then we have a problem. I love watching my wife put, I love watching her put men in check. It's just amazing how she does it. And then men who come off all hard, they feel this big. So I understand what you're saying. So I don't try to take the power away from my wife.
I do want to follow up with another question that I think hopefully will help us to bridge some of these topics, but I want to start with Yasmir Reyes' prophetic Five Tips for Queer Boys, and it's building from James Baldwin. Those of you not familiar with James Baldwin should definitely check that out soon.
Yes.
But it examines the internalized oppression that queer men of color feel because of homophobia and white supremacy, and the quote is, "Know that you have been conditioned to hate every fiber of your being through a history that has demonized your spirit, but before times like these, you were celebrated and honored. Don't act on insecurities. Oppression will lead you to believe that we are men, and because of it, predatory and patriarchal sex is something that we embody. This is false. Violence comes in many forms, and oftentimes we are the perpetrators of our own demise." So I'd like us to maybe talk a little further, like, how does masculinity, the standards of masculinity of which we talk about, this is about queer men of color's responses to hegemonic masculinity in many ways, but also a system of white supremacy, as you point out. What are some examples of the ways that you maybe have experienced hegemonic masculinity as a self-hatred or internalized oppression? And how does it impact your relationship with other men in your life, more specifically? Because if homophobia is the framework of hegemonic masculinity, how can you have relationships with one another? Who wants to talk?
I'll talk on this. So, I don't know. I will be the first to admit that I have a little phobia with heterosexual men and creating relationships with them because I'm afraid that our relationship is going to be changed once I come out to them, or if they haven't realized, or even from the very beginning, that our relationship is going to have a different tone because they're going to think that I want to have sex with them, which is not true. Most of the time, I do not want to have sex with someone who is not going to be interested in having sex with me. I don't know. That's a personal thing that I have. So,
it's a good rule.
Yeah. If you don't want to have sex with me, I'm not going to try to engage in having sex with you. I don't know. That them being intrigued by me is kind of, I don't know, a turn on? Is that bad to say? But also talking about this, like, perpetrating violence against yourself, maybe not physical violence, but mental violence. I know that, like, there's an expectation for, I feel like I get very emotional and that I feel like I can't express those feelings, and I need to make sure that I'm in check and I don't let people know that I am freaking out on the inside. And so I actually consistently have these kind of mental breaks that I actually have a friend in here and a couple of friends that have experienced these kind of mental breaks that I've had in there. It's just really hard. Like, it's really hard because I have to bottle up, because I have to man up. I have to straighten up so that people take me seriously and take my voice seriously when I'm entering different spaces. I'm not allowed to be who I am because I have to package a certain message, and I also don't want people to notice that I have weaknesses, because otherwise people are going to take advantage of me, because they have before. So, I don't know.
Yeah. And I think, kind of just piggybacking on that, you know, for me, because I'm Dr. Joel Fillmore, I have power and privilege that someone who doesn't have the backing of that doctorate degree would have. That being said, that hasn't always been the case. And so, you know, I'm biracial, half black and half white, and born in 1970. And, you know, I grew up in a really small rural town in Michigan where, kind of like Dr. Wood, there were no other people of color except me and my brother. And then the immigrants who would come during the summer to work on our farms. And so I grew up first with the self-loathing of my skin color. And so when my sexuality, you know, puberty hit, and I realized every other boy in town wasn't in love with the Dukes of Hazzard like I was, I realized then I found another reason to hate myself. And in my town, we didn't talk about and sissies and homosexuals, because those words just were never talked about in my community. So I didn't know there was such a thing. All I knew is that I liked boys. But I also knew that that was wrong. And so in my 12-year-old mind, the only way that I could fix it was to come to the conclusion that God had made a mistake and I was supposed to be a girl, because girls like boys. And so my grandmother sold Avon, and that's who raised me, my Norwegian grandmother. And so I started dressing up like a girl when I was 14 years old as a way to kind of reconcile my burgeoning sexual identity with the reality of the kind of ideology of what masculinity and what femininity was. And I clearly fit in the feminine box. So fast forward to teen years, early 20s, I lived the first 34 years of my life as a female. I took hormones, I was transgender, and as sexy as I look now, I was that beautiful as a woman. Yes, I was. And so I'm living in Chicago as a woman, and I've taken on this identity as a woman because, again, and it's a hyper-sexualized identity because I was raised in Western society like all the rest of you. And so my identity as a female was hyper-sexualized. Well, that led me into a world of sex trafficking. I became a victim of sex trafficking. And I'm in Chicago selling myself on the streets, hooked on crack cocaine and heroin, and living as a woman and not realizing the power I had because I had taken on this socialized construct of what it meant to be a woman. And it wasn't until I went to prison that I was able to kind of shake that off, and I had to make a decision. Do I want to go through the rest of my life like this, or do I want to take back my own identity of what it means to be a man? And I like to think of myself as masculine light, you know? And that's okay. And understanding that I don't have to be the two gentlemen right here, Aaron and Coach and Big and Buff, although it would be nice. I might have a little bit of size on me. I wouldn't mind it. You know what I'm saying? But that being said, I'm okay with me. I love the color of my skin, and I love the way that I love how I present. And I'm in a place now that, you know, thinking about the hierarchy and stratifications of the way that we are built, men are better than women, white is better than black, straight is better than gay. You know, I've come to a place in the 44 years of being on this earth that I realized that it is absolutely okay for me to be who I am. And it's not my job to help you to redefine who you are in my presence. I'm not trying, and I'm not picking on Sue. Sue's a great guy. Love you, Sue. You know, my hope is not to make another man uncomfortable in my presence. I would hope that I present myself in such a way that they say, well, let me get to know this person first. That being said, thinking about Dr. Wood's presentation, he talked about how men are socialized and how that socialization leads to this ideology that anything that identifies with femininity is weakness. And so on Monday, we had a kind of all-male presentation, something like this, and I asked all the guys in the room, I said, how many of you men in this room have female friends that you do not want to have sex with? And most of them raised their hand. And I said, well, how many of you men have gay males in your who are your friends? And like three people raised their hand. And I said, so you're saying you have the strength of will to not have sex with all your female friends, but we don't. What does that say? Now, I'm not, you know, I think Alex is a bigger man than me, because there are some men that are not gay that I want to have sex with. I'm going to be real. They are fine, and I'm just like, cha-ching. But I'm married, and I'm faithful, and I keep it real. That being said, I'm not about to take it. I could, but I'm not about to. And I think therein lies a lot of fear with heterosexual men, because a lot of heterosexual men are they're afraid that gay men are going to do the same thing to them that they do to women.
And sorry, I just want to make a disclaimer on what I said. I don't ever like go through life without going, hey. just engaging into a relationship, there's just definitely...
But we're not going to take it.
Yeah.
We're not going to take it.
Yeah.
Garvin, is there something that you wanted to ask? Was there... Oh, no.
Jesse? I have a question. No, go ahead. We haven't heard from Jesse. Hey, Jesse, how about this? How do we stop the cycle?
I mean, I don't know. I guess I can speak on my personal experience. I mean, I think for me, it plays back more to the cultural piece, just because growing up Hispanic and Mexican-American, those values are integrated within me. So the patriarchal society is part of it, is there. And so it's like, it's not only within my family, but obviously within the society. So in the whole cultural Christian scenario, I feel like it is a patriarchal society. So in a sense, it's like I don't know how I would change it or how you would create a ripple to change it. But I just have to. I mean, that's I don't know where I'm going with that.
Yeah.
You ask how can we change it. I'm just going to be honest. I mean, we all being honest here. I think it all goes back to education, not necessarily to what's in the books. It all goes back to education. I'm originally from Las Vegas, so you guys see a lot of stuff on TV that happens in Las Vegas. And here's why I'm going to the education part of it. Not a lot of people want to get to know other people, because when we talk about heterosexuals and homosexuals, the first thing that a lot of people end up talking about is, oh, well, you know, all homosexuals, they have AIDS, or they like you, the whole stereotypes. When you don't really get a chance to get to know somebody, you don't go up and ask that person, hey, how you doing, where you from, what's your name, so on and so forth. And I think that will end up taking care of the whole stereotypes as to what's going on. And it's not just in that. I mean, it's in every walk of life, whether, you know, the whole stereotype with, oh, well, all blacks are gangbangers. Well, all blacks aren't gangbangers. You know, all white people are rich. Well, they're not all rich. Everything like that. So I think it all just goes back to education and getting to know the people as people, not as a homosexual male or a lesbian female or a heterosexual person. You get to know the person for who they are, what they're about, their character. That's the main thing. And then I think that's when, I'm not going to say the cycle will stop, per se, but it can kind of start slowing it down, so to speak.
And it goes into with women too. It's more difficult to treat a woman in a degrading way if you have personified them. If you have suddenly they're no longer an object, but they're Mary Jo Klinker, who I've spent a lot of time getting to know, as opposed to I'm in the club, I'm getting my tipsy on, and I see something that looks good, and she's wearing a little tight skirt. And then turns around as your sister. You're like, what the hell? You know? And so understanding that it happens. But understanding that it's a lot more. It's about taking it into that realm. And I think the older I get, the more curmudgeonly I get. And I think, well, you know, the whole idea of club scene is kind of messed up anyways, but I digress. To me, it's really about this idea of not allowing ourselves to, I think a lot of us, we allow ourselves to be used, because the one thing that we're all looking for is connection. And sometimes we achieve that connection through illegitimate means.
Alex?
I guess I'll have a little bit different perspective. I think it's just more simplistic. You mentioned about self-hate. And I can't generalize, but I'm just thinking about men. So you bring up all these theories. Dr. Naeem Akbar, used to be one of the nation's leading African-American psychologists, said there's a difference between being a male, a boy, and a man. Well, I'm 52 years old, and I know some men my age that are boys that are still manipulating the system, that are still acting like boys. They want things. We don't have enough men teaching young men or young boys how to be men. And what I mean by that is, I was thinking about the female that was sitting here, and I just thought about something you said. When was the last time you told a man that you loved him? If you can't love yourself, how can you love someone else? So when we start talking about quote-unquote manly values, young men or boys will say power, respect, control, commitment, dedication, loyalty. But they never talk about love. So if you don't love yourself, and I love me, my mama taught me how to love me. Because I got people that your complexion, some of your complexion, my own people even hate on me. So I got to love myself before I can love anyone else. But Dr. Wood, no, I tell him, Brother Luke, I love you. I love what you do. But we can't tell each other that, because then we're seen less of man or gay. So if we can't start with the love process and teaching men that they have to love their sons and love other men, I see the cycle continuing on as it is now.
What's interesting is when a man tells another man he loves him, he probably typically, at least what I've noticed, follows it up with a statement that then kind of puts back down. So, I love you, you jerk, or I love you, fucking bitch. I guess that's what we say to each other.
I love you, and then, no homo.
But it didn't mean anything. You just messed it up. Or we do it, like you said, when it comes to females. We take advantage of females using alcohol. We'll use it. Man, I love you. Man, thank you for helping me for getting home. I love you. Next day, what's up? So now, the person who uses that as a, we see more African-Americans use it, that tells me you don't have any self-respect for yourself by using that word, because it's chattel property. So now I got to be somebody's property. So it depends on who you are. I don't have a lot of friends, sorry. Because we don't have the like-mindedness of what a man is and how you treat another human being. I don't care if he's gay. One quick story. We're coming home from church one day, and we're driving this Oldsmobile Delta 88, lime green. And my friends, who are not friends anymore, would call a couple of the males that I know gay punks. So I yelled out of the back, said, "Hey, now go that." Next thing I know, I was laying down in the floor. My mother's hand came out of nowhere. She said, "Son, this has been going on since the beginning of time. So where is, we taught you better than that. Where's your humanity and civility?" So I think it's, you know, what we hear, what we listen to, how we're raised, and what we model.
Do you mind if we...
We have several questions, yeah.
Yeah, you could go.
Senator Holliday.
The following statement was made. In broadcast media and social media, we see being gay is a problem. I do not see any real progress. I think the only way we can have progress is if we all act to change the culture. What are your thoughts?
Can we extend on that just real quick?
Yeah.
And maybe you can do this, you don't have to take this question. But when you said the media, it made me think of a number of different things, but what is the role of pornography in all this? You know, as I asked a question, I didn't want to answer it, so.
Just you.
You can talk about other people.
I mean, I'm just saying it's there. I mean, it's available to you. I mean, whether you want to look at it online as far as, you know, but the thing is, like, it's available to us at a, such an early age now. I mean, beforehand, I mean, I don't know, I'm speaking for Mr. Hines, but, I mean, I don't know if, obviously, a person at that age, but, you know, it's like, the internet wasn't as accessible, it wasn't accessible, so it's like, that technology piece, it wasn't there, and so, like, our minds, our systems, or whatever it is, are, it's changing, and it's evolving, and we're having to, like, be able to deal with it at such an early age, and yet are we even capable to actually handle that? I don't know. I mean, that's...
Is it desensitizing us to sexual aggression?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
I would say so.
You know, I do research on sexuality, and one of the things that the literature says is research shows that there's a strong correlation between hardcore pornography viewing and this with specifically with males and early onset erectile dysfunction. And what they're showing is that young boys who start out viewing hardcore pornography on the internet, you know, at 8, 9, 10 years old, by the time they get to college, they have to engage in much more aggressive, much more graphic, degrading behavior in order to get turned on. And so there's absolutely a correlation between that. I mean, when I was a kid, I found my grandfather's Hustler magazine. Those are mild in comparison to what kids have access to now at the touch of a finger, so.
Could we, because there are a few people with questions, maybe let's go through the questions and then people on the panel can respond to them because we're getting closer to time. So Lee, do you want to share yours? And we'll just, everyone ask a question before we respond.
The following set of questions were asked of the panel. Do men recognize the power that they have and the fear they can invoke? For instance, a female walking alone at night on a street and a male may be behind her not far away. The next question was, can you tell me about the differences between cultures in relation to hegemonic masculinity? The final question asked of the panel was, what is Winona State University doing about hegemonic masculinity on this campus, and what is the reaction to the Reinitiative project that is starting? Also, do you have any suggestions or feedback for the Reinitiative program?
Why don't we, because we're getting closer to time, we have these set of questions and comments. How will each person on the panel respond to something that is really thought-provoking to them that they want to add? Is that good? Do you want to start, Jesse, and then we'll go down?
I think the one that hit me the most was probably like the difference between the cultures. And I guess for me, just growing up, it's something where growing up, I've been able to tell my dad, you know, it's like, I love him, but to get that response isn't there. So that's something that I grew up with. So it's like, you already know, I mean, you already don't say it to your dad who you know that loves you. So how are you going to say it to another man just that you don't know it's not even part of your family? So that's something that I definitely grew up with and still grow up with and still deal with, where, you know, having the conversation with my brothers, and now that they have kids, and, you know, you see my little nephews telling my brothers, I love you, and, you know, hugging them. And that's something that, you know, it's like, as I see my brothers kind of communicating with my dad and all of us, it's something where we're just like, we don't have that. You know, we never got that growing up. But it's something that we can see and we recognize that we can change. I guess so that would be a change in the culture and in that sense. Another thing was as far as recognizing the differences between the power that we do hold, I definitely recognize it. It's something that I recognize in a way where, yeah, we're walking. But you also recognize where I'm just like, I didn't know I was that offensive, or I didn't know, is it because of my skin color? Is it because I'm a male? Is it because, was I dressed inappropriate? I mean, what is it? I'm like, you know, it's like you see, it's a dark alley. I'm like, well, I'm just trying to get home. Or trying to get to my truck in the parking lot. So it's just a matter of a sense. I was like, majority of the times, I would say most of the men, at least in my case, are just trying to do their own thing. But I do recognize that I do have a sense of power. And I can relate back again to the cultural piece where, you know, we were all texting, me, my brothers, and my sister, and we were talking about, oh, well, how easy it is for the male to just get up and go and carry their family wherever they go. But as for my sister, she's not able to do that. And she's like, well, you know, you guys just don't understand being the female. And in a sense, that's where we relate. It's like, no, well, you have to have that conversation with both spouses, or, you know, in a sense, it's like, but in reality, it's a reality check for me and my brothers, where it's like, well, if we wanted to, we could just get up and go. And so that's just also another piece where I recognize as another, again, it's a patriarchal thing, but the privilege that as a male I do have.
So I'm talking about the recognizing power and such. With my current identity, I do not want to engage in sexual intercourse with women. However, when there's a scene that I come across a lot when I'm out is a very drunk lady trying to get home, and she's walking by herself in the dark. And I know I get very concerned for that person because they're walking alone. And I don't know, do I try to approach her and say if she needs help going home, and what is she going to be thinking with me? Like, the kind of, what kind of message is that going to send to her? Like, here's this man approaching me at nighttime asking to take me home, when I just want to take her home and then get my own ass home because I do not want to have sex with her. You know, like, maybe, like, I'm always, like, afraid about how I'm going to negotiate. So depending on the situation, I'll either approach her and ask her if she wants me to walk her home, or I'll just be like, oh, God, please, like, get home okay. There's also going to the differences between cultures. You know what? Never mind. That one takes a while for me to unpack, so I don't, in the interest of time, I'm not going to talk about gay culture and gay male cisgendered culture and how that kind of negotiates with being penetrated and things like that. And then with the reinitiative thing, awesome. Love you guys. Y'all awesome.
I want to touch base on the power piece. It's very important because I know that I am powerful and I use that in a way to manipulate others and stuff like that. And I know that it's very uncomfortable. You know, I've been in being incarcerated and back out, and like, I got a lot of knowledge, like tons of knowledge, and being able to do therapy and go to treatment and stuff like that. So, like, I have that, like, the double consciousness. So it's like, I have to recognize my P's and Q's and make sure that I don't put anybody in an uncomfortable position, such as walking down the street at night, you know, seeing a lady. I have to know that, okay, I can totally empathize with this or how she might feel. And one of the greatest things that I learned is doing role plays, and you really have to really connect with each other, because as human beings, we are soul and spirit, and you know, we have to understand and come to grips with ourselves that we are lovable, valuable, important, and most of all, powerful. So once we recognize this, we can stop the cycle, because we learn how to treat ourselves with love. Okay, I'm lovable, I'm valuable. Now, if I value myself, I can value others. Cultures, others' identity, on and on. That's all I got.
Well, just kind of talking about the cultural piece, I'm biracial and identify as African-American, and my husband's Puerto Rican, and if you know anything about those cultures, in both those cultures, hyper-masculinity is really the norm. And so for us to be gay was very much a challenge for our families. I think the thing that really helped us overcome, I mean, initially in our relationship, I couldn't even sit next to my husband when I went to his family's house, because he's like, my dad will kill us. You know, he knows we're together, but you have to sit on the other side of the room. But I think the thing that really kind of helped overcome that kind of stereotype of what it means to be a man, because in the Black community, a lot of times I've been told I'm not a man because I'm gay, I think it really has to do about how you carry yourself. And I think that's pretty much the norm for all men. And somebody asked earlier, how do we start to change that? I think this is how we change it, having these conversations in a way that's non-defensive, and learning to carry ourselves and be able to stand up and take that ridicule that says, you know, I'm gonna be Captain Save-A-Ho today, but I'm not going to let you take advantage of this young lady.
In reference to the culture aspect, I am a triracial, Cubano, African-American, and Caucasian, mixed with a lot of other stuff. And experience-wise, as previously stated, grew up with women. My mother, four sisters, all raised me. And in that aspect, I grew up protecting women, so I know when to step in and know when to observe from a distance on whether or not they can handle the situation themselves, or in the case of stated earlier, getting them home safe after a night of having fun. But power-wise, power, that was recognized at an earlier age, being an African-American male. That's noticed when someone looks at you and you can see the look in their eyes of disgrace, disgust, or see them turn around, walk the other way. So power is a two-sided coin. It can go both ways. power is obvious, it's obvious, but it takes a little different perspective to recognize what the other individual has power-wise.
I'll go to the power thing as well. Sorry, Dr. Wood, I may go a little bit over. But we know it as men, kind of like what Aaron hit on. I especially notice it being African-American as well as an athlete. I'll just kind of give a story that just happened the other day when I was walking into my apartment complex that I live in and got on the elevator, and it was me and a Caucasian girl. And first thing she did, she kind of looked at me when I got on the elevator, and then she kind of backed up towards the back of the elevator, clutched her purse, and then just kind of stared at me. Now, me, the one thing that I did, I engaged in conversation. Hey, how you doing? You know, what's going on? How was your night? Blah, 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 yada, yada, yada. I just want to go home. I came back from yelling at guys and all of that stuff throughout the day. But that's the main thing. A lot of guys know that they have the power, but at the same time, it's what can you do to make people feel comfortable? And I try to make people feel comfortable and realize that whatever their stereotype is of me, that, again, if I can change one person, then hopefully they end up telling somebody. Kind of the whole thing I was talking about earlier, it's all about the whole educational piece. And I wasn't going to rob her. I mean, that's not what I'm here to do. I'm here to make better men. But that's kind of the one thing. We know we have it, and it is sometimes hurtful on our part when we do walk down the street and it's us and someone else, and the first thing that we know they're thinking is, oh shit, what am I going to do? I don't want to cross the street to you know, kind of make it obvious, you know, but at the same time, you know, I hope he doesn't say anything. I hope he doesn't do anything or what have you. I come to work at 4:15 in the morning. I leave at about 10:30, 11 o'clock at night. And it's a cycle all over again. I just want to come to work and go home. If I pass by people in the dark, fine, so be it. But I'm not, a lot of people know it, that we have the power, but a lot of people are really, like Jesse said, we just want to get to where we got to, point A to point B. That's it.
Beauty of headphones.
Yes.
My mother's in a retirement unit, and there aren't any men. It's all women. And men are dying 6-7 years younger in America, 13 years younger in Eastern Europe. I think it's about saving men's lives. I think traditional masculinity is toxic. The power is toxic. We drink too much, we drive too fast, we don't wear sunscreen, we don't wear our seat belts. We know we don't do it, but we want to be men, and it kills us. Mm-hmm. And I don't want to see that for you and me. You know, I want to be 95 in a retirement home, staring at a fish tank, you know. Like, look, there's a new fish, man. Just give me one fish, that's all I have. But how do we get there? I think we have to take this journey that Aaron's talking about, that Joel's talking about, Tony's talking about, to figure out what it means for you. And so if our spouses and our girlfriend, our family members can help us unpack it and say, wait a minute, how do you feel? And we don't have to have that awful moment when we go like, I don't know. You know, we're not in touch with our emotions. We're conditioned not to be. So let's discover those emotions. Discover the affection. Have the hugs. Say I love you. Live full lives and live long lives. And that's what I hope all this can produce.
As far as recognizing that males have power towards the female, I love my mother. I'm more likely to commit an aggressive act against one of them, because I know I won't do it to a female, but one of them I will. So that comes back to that part of, I guess, that masculinity of that male-on-male crime. As far as pornography, and I gotta say this first. I know you said 30 seconds. I have to thank all of you for putting yourself out there, because what I'm thinking about now is we put ourselves out there. How is this conversation going to go back with this audience? That judge ye lest ye not be judged thing. But going back to the pornography, I watch pornography. It becomes a fantasy for men. And the things they see in those movies, not generalizing, that that's how we can treat you as that object again. You're not a woman to love. That's just kind of like a, you like John, how many of y'all like John Legend? Save Room for My Love. Nobody looks at that video and sees that he has 21 women in that video talking about save room for my love, but he's not saving his love for you. So, you know, I think it's a respect thing, how we treat women, how we even treat ourselves, and the Reinitiative Project. I'm just going to put it out there. I'm tired of the Caucasian female and male savior. When it comes to cultural, we need to talk about our different cultural dynamics of masculinity. And we need to talk about the intersectionality of the cultural piece as well. So, you know, I'm getting kind of fed up with that. And if the older men that's in this room, if you're doing this work, you can't have the conversations with us. Either one, go work with older men to get out of this work. Because we have different issues than you want to discuss. So, thank you. And I'd like to thank you all for attending. Let's give Dr. Mary Jo Klinger and Dr. Wood a hand again.
Thanks again to Dr. Jonathan Luke Wood, Dr. Mary Jo Klinker, and to all those who participated during the panel discussion on hegemonic masculinity. Tune in for our next episode of Culture Click when we visit one-on-one with Dr. Wood on his background and research on masculinity. Another thank you goes out to the Winona State University Inclusion and Diversity Office and KEEP, that's K-E-A-P, Diversity Resource Center, who sponsored the event. More information on Winona State University's Inclusion and Diversity Department can be found at www.winona.edu/inclusion-diversity. I'm Terry Tenseth, and you've been listening to Culture Click.
Creating cultural awareness and understanding. You've been listening to Culture Click. Support for Culture Click is made possible by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. Culture Click is produced by KQAL-FM on the campus of Winona State University. For more information, look us up on the web at kqal.org. And thanks for listening to Culture Click.